You're listening to a podcast hosted by Med Learning Group.
Welcome to this podcast on psoriasis hosted by Med Learning Group. This podcast is second in a series of two geared toward dermatologists, advanced practice providers, and others involved in the management of psoriasis. In this podcast, we once again have Dr. Joel Gelfand, who will be discussing a few concepts around newer treatments, as well as some of the implications of shared decision-making to improve management of these patients with psoriasis. Once again, my name is Chris, and I'll be the host of today's podcast. So I'd like to welcome back Dr. Gelfand. Dr. Gelfand is James J. Layden Professor of Dermatology and Epidemiology and Director of the Center of Clinical Sciences and Dermatology and Director of the Psoriasis and Phototherapy Treatment Center at the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine. Great to have you back with us for our second podcast, Dr. Gelfand.
Yeah, it's great to be with you, Chris, and looking forward to the conversation.
So in our first podcast, we talked about some of the mechanisms underlying psoriasis and the treatment targets that stem from these mechanisms and kind of what's been happening over the past 10 years or so. I wanted to talk a little bit more about the JAK-STAT and TYK2 pathways to start this podcast. So let's start with the JAK inhibitors. Where are we with these agents for the treatment of psoriasis?
Yeah, so in the treatment of psoriasis for the skin disease itself, we're not making that much progress, at least from a regulatory point of view. Tofacitinib was in phase 3 clinical trials, large-scale studies, had effectiveness comparable to, say, etanercept, a biologic which is relatively not so effective for skin psoriasis relative to newer options, but never got approval by the FDA, largely for safety concerns. And I think the agency's perspective is that we have a lot of excellent options for moderate to severe psoriasis, and therefore the risk-benefit ratio they probably felt not as comfortable with JAK inhibitors. Now, in psoriatic arthritis, it's a different story. We have not made the kind of progress in the treatment outcomes for psoriatic arthritis that we have in psoriasis. Responses are still fairly modest when it comes down to it. TNF inhibitors are still more or less best in class management for psoriatic arthritis, as well as probably IL-17 inhibitors as well. JAK inhibitors here are finally making some inroads. Certainly tofacitinib has been approved for a while for psoriatic arthritis, but upadacitinib, another JAK inhibitor, is likely a little better in the skin than is tofacitinib, and therefore when I have PSA patients, it's a drug I'm often reaching for. Of course, we in dermatology are now having a lot of experience with JAK inhibitors more broadly. Upadacitinib is approved for atopic dermatitis. JAKs are emerging for treatment of alopecia areata. And so we're becoming more comfortable and more knowledgeable in using these. I often find them very useful when I'm talking about psoriatic disease patients, is those with tough arthritis and maybe more of an eczematous phenotype in their psoriasis. Those patients do really well on JAK inhibitors, upadacitinib in particular is where I tend to use. Those patients who have developed, you know, sort of a pustular variant of psoriasis in the setting of a TNF inhibitor for, say, ulcerative colitis or rheumatoid arthritis, you know, upadacitinib is a really nice option in that setting because it works great for those diseases, but also tends to really clear up these type of psoriasiform eruptions patients sometimes develop from TNF inhibitors in my own experience. And of course, we have, TYK2 inhibitors now, which are really in the JAK family to some extent, but they're not really JAK inhibitors. They're distinct. The FDA has some concerns that maybe they may have JAK-like safety effects, though for the most part, that's not been borne out in clinical trials. You may see a little bit more, say, zoster in some of the TYK2 data, but not the way you see with JAK inhibitors, for example, true JAK inhibitors.
So you mentioned the TYK2 inhibitors. What's currently available for inhibition of TYK2 and maybe what's coming down the pipeline in this area?
Yeah, so we really only have one TYK2 inhibitor, deucravacitinib. It's a once-a-day medication for psoriasis, approved by the FDA, several months back now. So very nice option for our patients. As I mentioned previously in our other discussion, you know, head-to-head trials, clearly a more effective therapy compared to, say, apremilast, which is currently our leading oral therapy in that setting. And it has biologic-like efficacy, probably about as effective as, say, a TNF inhibitor, like maybe adalimumab, for example, although it's not direct trials, it's sort of an indirect estimate we would think about. There's certainly a number of other companies developing TYK2 inhibitors. They're very promising in a lot of domains, lupus, possibly inflammatory bowel disease, Crohn's, ulcerative colitis, and other inflammatory conditions. And so it's likely that these therapies will be playing a big role in medicine in general. There'll be many diseases that will hopefully respond to it. And so we're looking forward to seeing how this data emerges and whether or not additional indications come out. Yeah, the way we have, say, for example, TNF inhibitors, you know, and also say IL-23 inhibitors, they're just indicating many different disease states, and that's often very useful in a patient population like psoriasis, where they often have comorbid inflammatory conditions.
So, what might be an example of a case, maybe a specific patient in whom TYK2 inhibition may be appropriate? Are we talking about failure of other options first, or is there a circumstance where a TYK2 inhibitor may be used initially for moderate to severe disease?
Well, certainly from the agency's perspective, the FDA now, they consider it to be approved for moderate to severe psoriasis. They haven't given it a label where you have to have failed other therapies beforehand. So that's different than, say, JAK inhibitors for psoriatic arthritis. There, JAK inhibitors tend to be second-line agents, and that's primarily due to safety concerns. They're relatively safe therapies, but I think compared to our standard biologics, they probably are a little less safe. So deucravacitinib, you know, has head-to-head data with a apremilast, clearly very well tolerated in that setting. You know, from a labeling point of view, there were lymphomas, a few observed in the clinical trial development program with deucravacitinib. And so that's in the label, for example. And that's pretty anxiety provoking, at least in my patient population, and people have to be counseled about that. So they understand that this is a very rare phenomenon and unlikely to occur for them. And at this stage, we really don't even know if the drug causes this problem or just bad luck in terms of developmental program. So that being said, I think it's an appropriate therapy for a patient who is struggling with their psoriasis. And, you know, prefers an oral medication, it's a very good option for them. It's probably not a great option for people who, say, have bad arthritis, because we don't have a clear indication for psoriatic arthritis in that circumstance. We don't really know for sure how well it will work in people who have tried and failed biologics that target the immune mechanisms that we think deucravacitinib works by. So for example, if someone truly failed ustekinumab, an IL-12/23 inhibitor, or risankizumab, an IL-23 inhibitor, you know, a lot of us would say, you know, I think it's probably not going to work in that patient population. You know, especially they were like primary failures. I mean, they were not, never responded to it. If they lost response, maybe they should do just as well on deucravacitinib. And so clearly, a lot of our patients who walk through the door are good candidates for this medication. A lot of it comes down to shared decision-making with the patient. And of course, the payers have a lot to say about it as well. Depending where you are in the country, the payer may say, no, you can't try that. You have to try this.
So then what are your thoughts on where we are with the biologics? And what I mean by that is we went from TNF inhibitors to IL-12/23, then IL-17, and then IL-23 alone. And now we're talking about small molecules, the JAK inhibitors and the TYK2 inhibitors. So there's a lot of agents available from several different classes, which is great for personalized treatment. But the shift has kind of moved to oral agents and new classes, you know, notwithstanding the recent bimekizumab approval. But are we more or less done with developing biologics at this point?
I think certainly not, actually. I mean, there's a lot of, there's still a lot of developmental space, a lot of development going on in the space of biologics. New ways of manufacturing antibiotics, so-called nanobodies that are a little bit easier to make, may have better tissue penetration, things of that nature will likely come to market in the coming years. Whether or not we're looking at new targets with biologics, you know, beyond IL-17 pathway or 23 pathway, that's unclear. It seems like that's where the development is. But I think there will be still some continued development in that arena. I think what's kind of exciting is the use of what's called oral biologics, the ability to take small peptides that essentially function like biologics, you know, that they could block the receptor for IL-23, for example, and essentially work like an IL-23 biologic would work, right? These are available by mouth, orally. The companies have come up with incredible technologies that allow the peptides to be absorbed through the GI tract without being completely digested in the stomach. And there's, you know, initial data of some of these molecules where the efficacy is quite promising. And that would be, you know, probably another game changer, because I think patients still often prefer an oral medication. You know, a lot of people don't like injections. They're either afraid of needles, or they have, you know, what's essentially the misperception that it's an injection, it must be riskier or more serious. It's actually not really the case when you just look at the data. You know, the cold and hard facts of data that injectables are as safe or safer than oral medications and better tolerated. But it's the reality of how U.S. patients think about these issues.
So I wanted to shift over to shared decision making. I guess gone are the days where a clinician would simply tell a patient what they should take to get better. Maybe in the past, the clinician was more of an authority figure, but there's been a big move towards making decisions together with the patient. That's been kind of ongoing for the past couple decades, at least. But why is this? What's the benefit of shared decision-making?
I think psoriasis is the classic model of the need for and the benefits of shared decision-making. And personally, in my own practice, I find it incredibly rewarding, okay? Because our patients, you know, are truly the experts in their disease. They've been living with it oftentimes for decades. They may be coming to you, if you're newly seeing a patient, they may be coming to you skeptical of you as a clinician because they've already maybe tried and failed things. They were told this therapy is going to work great and maybe didn't work great, or maybe they lost response to it and so they felt like they were misled. And so it's really important for us as clinicians to understand a patient's perspective, the burden they're facing with their disease, how it impacts their relationships, their work, their day-to-day activities, how they feel about themselves, what their prior treatment experience has been, what their preferences are. And then from there, we can help them choose the best course of action. You know, so I'll just give you an example. You know, I have a patient whose sibling had severe Crohn's disease, was severely disabled by it. You know, you probably don't want to use a therapy that has a warning for developing Crohn's disease on it. It's a really emotional barrier for that individual. You know, so I tend to steer away from, say, 17s and people have strong family histories of inflammatory bowel disease. Similarly, they have a strong family history of multiple sclerosis. I'm going to steer away from TNF inhibitors. And the other thing is that some patients are reluctant to go on systemic therapies. And I feel like being patient with them, continuing the conversation at each visit about where they are, how they feel about things, what their preferences are as things are evolving in their life, as their life moves forward, is always a great approach. And eventually, when patients are ready, they'll choose the therapy that's right for them. And they are always, in my experience, incredibly grateful for the patients we've had working through other therapies that they may have preferred before they get to the one that is really able to clear their skin and get them a full return to basically normal health.
So let's finish up this series with just a few final thoughts. As someone who sees psoriasis on a daily basis, how do you feel about where we are with our current panel of treatments and management in general? And what do you look at for, say, the next 5 years?
I think we have a great panel of therapies. I think where we're not making progress is one, understanding the impact of our treatments on comorbidities. There's some perceptions out there, well, if we treat the skin, it should lower the risk of arthritis or lower the risk of cardiovascular disease. We really don't know the answer to that question. You need well-designed, randomized controlled trials that are long-term to answer that. And so that's a big gap in our knowledge. We also just don't do a great job of comprehensive care of our patients. You know, we recently published a paper using CDC data showing that if you're 40 or older and see a dermatologist for psoriasis, less than 10% of the time is your blood pressure checked. Less than 3% of the time to get screened for cholesterol or diabetes. That's a huge gap in what we know needs to be done for our patients, that they have higher cardiovascular risk, they develop more diabetes, they die younger, often from cardiovascular disease. And we really need to be on the front lines here of educating our patients about it. initiating these screenings and building relationships with people in our community who could help patients with this issue. In my own practice, I have prevention cardiologists at Penn, and I regularly diagnose people with coronary disease in my practice. And if you're a dermatologist or clinician taking care of people with psoriasis and you've never diagnosed diabetes or coronary disease in your patients, this is an opportunity to go through the guidelines again, work with preventative cardiologists in the community. It's very simple to check cholesterol, check a blood pressure, check a hemoglobin A1C, and then refer them back to their primary doctor for further evaluation when these things are abnormal. You'll make a huge difference in your patients' lives.
Well, Dr. Galfan, thanks very much. I appreciate you taking the time to talk to our listeners today about newer treatments and kind of where we're headed as we try to improve on standards of care for psoriasis in clinical management. Once again, thank you, Dr. Galfan, for joining us, and thanks to all of our listeners for joining as well. As a reminder, this is the second in a series of two podcasts on this topic, so I invite you to circle back and listen to the first as well. Additionally, MedLearning Group offers many types of CME programs across a variety of the disease states, including several dermatology topics. I invite you to explore these on our website, www.medlearninggroup.com. This podcast was brought to you by MedLearning Group. MedLearning Group is accredited by the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education to provide continuing medical education for physicians. This CME activity was planned and produced in accordance with the ACCME Essentials. I would also like to give a special thank you to our grant supporter, Bristol-Myers Squibb, who provided unrestricted grants for this educational activity. Thank you very much, and have a great day.